Say hey, good looking. What you got cooking?
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and a very Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate the day. For all of us, let's settle in for a special hour of decadence, because we're going to talk about dessert. We'll be looking at some of our favorite conversations about those special sweet treats. We'll bring you stone-ground Mexican chocolate, handcrafted caramels, and some of the foundational techniques you'll need to bake some of the flakiest melt-in-your-mouth treats from James Beard Award-winning baker Joanne Chang. So loosen your belt buckles, grab a cup of hot chocolate, and enjoy.
How's about cooking something up with me?
Let's start with our delightful conversation with cookie maven and James Beard Award-winning chef and cookbook author Dori Greenspan. She's also the On Dessert columnist for the New York Times. Greenspan's latest book is called Dori's Cookies, and it is a delightful, boldly colored, and joyous book filled with mouthwatering recipes and photos which are almost as delightful as she is. We spoke with Dori just over a year ago, winter 2016.
I'm so happy to be here. And you sat me near the ginger molasses cookies. The smell of them is just so wafting over.
We have a multi-talented staff. Not only can they produce radio, but they can make these great cookies, which they made straight out of your cookbook.
And they are so beautiful. It makes me so happy to see them.
Okay, so why don't you... So tell me a little bit more about the double ginger molasses cookie. What's the story there?
So this cookie, the recipe for it was sent to me by my friend Christine. And I made them, and they came out the way ginger snaps always do, kind of flat and crunchy. And they were delicious. They were so delicious that I felt like they disappeared too quickly. And so I redid the recipe to make them in muffin tins so that they would be thicker and chewier and so that the flavor would last longer.
Well, I'm going to reach across the table here.
Here, have one. Oop, you need long arms.
Okay. Banging into the microphone and everything. And they are... so very good. I try not to eat on the radio. It's not very attractive, but these taste so good.
Well, I want you to eat, even if it is radio. So it has fresh ginger. The cookie has fresh ginger and dried ginger and chocolate and a little espresso. It's got a really interesting mix of spices.
So what is it about cookies that seems so elemental, such a primal source of joy? Is it just that they're sweet confections, or is there something more?
No, I think there's really something more. I think some of it has to do with how personal a cookie is. All yours, and you can eat it any way you want. But I also think we grow up on cookies. You know, my mother did not bake, used her oven for a bread box. But my memories are of cookies. And I found a picture of me holding our son at his first birthday party. And he's holding a homemade cookie.
Uh-huh.
I think, and he says, cookies are memories. And I think they are, because they're, even if they're not homemade, there's something that, a pleasure that we have very, very often. And I think it's always associated with a nice time.
So what's your memory cookie?
My memory cookie, actually, we have the classic jammer here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so this is a cookie that I dreamed. I was in Paris. I was working on the cookie book. And in the middle of the night, I saw a cookie. This doesn't always happen to me. But I saw it fully formed, beautiful. Kind of elbowed my husband and said, I dreamed a cookie. He rolled over. I think he's used to it. But in the morning, I got up and baked this cookie, and it was just as I had dreamed it was. It is nothing like anything that I had as a child.
So the recipe was in your dream, too?
Or everything. Just... everything. Okay. I just saw it. But the cookie is not really a cookie from childhood at all. I'll describe what it is in a second. But it's the butter and jam that reminds me of the Austrian-German cookies that my mother used to buy from a bakery near our house. So this cookie is, it's built also in a muffin tin. It's a vanilla shortbread cookie. It has jam in the center, and it has streusel around the edges. So you get the flakiness of the shortbread and the crunch of the streusel and that wonderful fruity flavor of jam.
Okay, I'm going to give it a try here because it also looks beautiful. It's a very attractive cookie.
It almost looks like a little tart.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when I was...
Oh. My staff is laughing at me on the other side of the glass. They're crying. These are good, guys. You did a good job.
Wait, wait. And I'm smiling because you bit it and then put your hand to your
I
heart.
Did.
Actually, the classic jammers are one of my favorites in the book. A little arts and crafts project.
So the book has hundreds of recipes.
170 yeah.
recipes. It also has tips, baking tips for cookies, which I find really helpful because I, unlike my producers, I am not a champion baker. I've always kind of struggled when it comes to baking. Other kind of cooking I can do because I find doughs to be very temperamental and they don't react well to me. So do you have a good tip or two for cookie baking?
So I made a discovery a few years ago that changed my life. And it has to do with cookies that you roll out and cut, which I think are the cookies that give people the most problems mm-hmm. because the dough should be cold and then the cookies should be cut very crisply. So I made this discovery that if you make the dough and roll it out immediately, put it between two pieces of parchment paper or wax paper, it's so easy. The real instructions were make the dough, put it in the refrigerator, and then when it was hard, roll it. Well, you can't roll it when it's hard. It just is impossible. But if you roll it when it's soft, it's totally submissive. It'll do anything you want. And then you chill it. And it makes making cutout cookies such a pleasure. Uh-huh. It's also helpful. Same technique for pie dough and tart dough.
Oh, okay.
Life changer.
Totally. I mean, my husband loves to make mince pies for mm-hmm. Christmas, and we have an almond shortbread recipe that we use for
delicious.
The tart part
right.
of the mince pie. And I have that problem every time because we've got to chill it. Then I got to beat it. And then I'm heating it up as I'm rolling it out, and it's getting very
and you're
upset
yelling at it.
Yeah.
It's And you're getting
apart.
Upset. Yep. Changed. This will be a better year, I promise.
We will try that. Okay. I want to ask you about another cookie here before we run out of time. The world peace cookie.
Oh, this cookie. So this cookie, it's a chocolate kind of shortbread cookie, kind of chocolate chip cookie. So it has both brown sugar and white sugar and cocoa, chunks of dark chocolate, and fleur de sel, sea salt. And I got this cookie, the recipe for it, from Pierre Hermé, who's a very famous French pastry chef. And he called it the Corova cookie because he had made it for a restaurant in Paris called Corova. And then shortly after I had published the recipe in my book, Paris Sweets, a neighbor of mine said, oh, I love your chocolate cookies, but we don't call them whatever that name is. We call them world peace cookies because if everyone in the world had these cookies, peace would reign.
Absolutely.
And they are, I can never get enough of these. I could make these every day and be happy making them. They're slice and bake cookies, so they're real easy.
Yeah, and I mean, look, they've got chocolate, and chocolate, and they just
there's that
fill you with happiness. We have just a few seconds here. Do you think you can just in 10 seconds tell me about cookies and kindness?
It's my sweet revolution. I'm trying to make the world sweeter. People, I would love you to bake cookies and tag them with the hashtag cookies and kindness. You can tag me at Dori Greenspan so I can see what you're doing. And let's just spread joy.
Dori Greenspan is a James Beard Award-winning chef and author of 12 cookbooks. Her latest is called Dori's Cookies, which won the James Beard Award for Best Baking and Dessert Cookbook last spring. You can find her recipe for classic jammers at our website, radioboston.org. Now it's tough to beat Dori Greenspan's bright, flavorful, and perfectly modern take on cookies. I mean, a cookie that appeared in a dream? But that emotional pull that cookies have over us really reminded me of a conversation we had with Yankee Magazine food editor Amy Traverso about 5 years ago. Amy had scoured the magazine's archives for classic New England cookie recipes, and she brought us a delicious tray of some of her favorites.
I love looking through the archives, particularly with food, and going through and seeing what was the food like in the 30s, what was it like in the 40s. It's been so much fun. So I wanted to see what Christmas cookies were over the decades. So I started with the 30s and found this amazing story. It was 100 potato recipes that were inspired by the potato farms up in Aroostook County, Maine, which used to be the largest potato growing region in the country. And I loved this recipe. It was a gingerbread potato. potato cookie. And if you think about the 1930s and the need to just make the most of everything during the Great Depression, no food going to waste, mm-hmm. there were all these ways people were using the readily available and inexpensive potato in sweet dishes.
Well, actually, I mean, you've brought the recipe as it originally appeared in Yankee Magazine in what year?
1937.
It says potato drop cookies dash molasses. And it's what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines long.
Yeah, it was a really short recipe. The format of recipes back then, you know, was basically you could assume that your readers had a basic working knowledge of cooking and you could sort of just give them rough instructions and it would come out okay.
Yeah, because it just says, you know, sugar, shortening, eggs, a couple other ingredients, and then it says flour enough for a stiff batter, then add 1 cup chopped raisins dropped on a grease pan in small spoonfuls, moderate oven.
Yeah. No cooking times, nothing like that. I'm adapting this recipe to sort of modern expectations. I wanted a different texture. The texture was a little dry for my taste. So we played around with adding a little more sugar, a little more butter.
So which one of the cookies
this
on the plate?
So this is this one. And this has little sliced apples on top. But okay. You could also decorate it with sprinkles to make it, you know, look festive. I kind of like the organic look. You can see it's very soft, very moist.
And it has that deep brown color of the molasses.
Yeah, of the molasses. The potato gives it a very moist texture. And they're almost like little tiny gingerbread cakes.
I'm going to try one of these.
Yeah,
so 1930s potato drop cookies from Yankee Magazine.
So really soft.
It is quite cakey.
It's very cakey. So that was sort of the taste then. So moving into the 40s, we have World War II and all the baking shortages.
When you say baking shortages, remind us what you
mean. Sorry. There were limits on the amount of sugar and other ingredients you could have.
Because of the war.
Yeah. So you had to make do with other ingredients. If you were out of your sugar ration for that month, what could you do? How could you bake? So what I actually found in a 1942 issue of Yankee is a recipe by the Rumford Baking Powder Company, which was based in Rhode Island, for a sugarless cookie. And I thought at first, well, that's not going to be any good because, you know, sugar, you need sugar for cookies. But then I realized I've had people come up to me when I do cooking demonstrations asking for cookies that are made with honey or maple syrup because they want to cook locavore. And I thought, well, the 1940s sugar ration recipe actually applies to today because we want to cook with our local ingredients and sugar is not local.
It calls for 1 1/4 cups of honey.
It's a lot of honey. And I found that the flavor was too strong. So I actually, in the updated recipe, it's a mixture of honey and maple syrup. And because you don't have sugar, again, it was a very cakey texture. I wasn't crazy about the texture, so I added a lot of chopped cranberries and walnuts to give it more body. So this is an entirely locavore recipe. This is local cranberries, local butter, local walnuts, which can be, you know, a little hard to find, but there are farms. I found a couple in Vermont and Connecticut that do sell black walnuts, so you can find them if you're determined. King Arthur flour, Cabot butter, local eggs. The only ingredient that is not local is vanilla. Now, you can skip the vanilla.
These smell amazing.
It's a very hearty, it feels like a good cookie to eat.
It does.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to put it to the test.
Yeah. So you get the tangy cranberry, mm-hmm. The crunchy walnut. So it kind of mixes up the texture a little
bit. And all local.
All local.
What I love in the article from Yankee Magazine, 1942, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Wartime baking helps.
Yeah. And I can only imagine how difficult it was to pull off the traditional. This recipe actually ran in our August issue, but Christmas is coming. You've used up your sugar ration and you still want to get those cookies out on the table. So, you know, magazines performed a really useful service.
So this is from the 1940s. Mm-hmm. Where are we moving to next?
Post-war America, 1950, 1958, this recipe appeared. In the 1950s, Yankee had a lifestyle guru named Duncan MacDonald, and she was quite a woman about town. She lived in Boston and wrote both about home decorating and fashion and food, which I love that Yankee had a fashion column at one point.
Maybe you should again.
Maybe you should. Actually, there's a lot of great designers now in New England. So we have this great story about discovering the multinational cooking that surrounds us. It's a great piece that argues that maybe we need to have a more diverse magazine. We need to have recipes from around the world because New England's full of many nationalities. And now, in the post-war period, people are beginning to travel to Europe. The sort of awareness of European cuisine is starting to grow.
So you brought the article in, her original article from February 1958. And I have to say, I'm kind of in love with Duncan MacDonald.
I am too.
I think her voice needs to be heard again. So I'm going to read a little bit of what she had to say. She said, quote, and again, this is 1958 Yankee Magazine. How could our cookery fail to achieve this variety in a community of 8 million people with about 60 nationalities living side by side and all faced with the problem of injecting interest into 21 meals a week? Exclamation point. A Greek recipe passes over the fence in exchange for one from France, Italy, Lithuania, or Camden, Maine! Exclamation point. But she's so spot on, though.
She is spot on. I love this this gentle push toward a more international culture.
And because they are our neighbors.
They are our
own family members in many cases.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me, you made a Greek cookie
from this
issue.
Yes, these are the nut crescents. Kourabiedes is the Greek name. It's a shortbread dough with nuts, and it's so simple and so good. I have to say, they're two of my favorite cookies are the nut cookies. And they're buttery and rich and wonderful, and then you roll them in powdered sugar. When I grew up, we ate them with pecans. We called them pecan puffs, and we made them into circles. But in this case, they're crescents. Apparently, though, in Greece now, the crescent shape came about during the era of Turkish rule.
Uh-huh.
Now in Greece, they tend to make them round, but somehow the crescent shape kind of took root in America, and you still see them a lot in
crescent interesting
shape.
How
politics shapes
Greece
cookies.
History, yes. How politics shapes cookies.
Well,
exactly.
And politics are shaping our locavore cookies, too. So
So I'm going to try one of these. What are we calling these again?
These are Greek crescent cookies. Nut cookies.
This one has crunch to it.
Yeah, so this is getting more into the familiar textures of
today.
Oh,
those are delicious.
Aren't they great? They're so good. They're so good.
Butter,
this is
powdered sugar, vanilla, flour, and pecans. That's it.
So simple. And a little. I added a little salt because I think, you know, sweet things need salt to really shine. And then you just roll them twice in powdered sugar, and they couldn't be easier. People go crazy for these. They're just kind of an addiction. The other nice thing is they keep for a couple weeks at room temperature in a nice, you know, airtight container. So now for the next recipe, I'm going to jump ahead several decades. This recipe is actually from the last decade, from about 2004. This is actually a recipe I developed for Yankee about 10 years ago. These are chocolate hazelnut shortbread tarts with
raspberry.
So this
is your recipe.
This is my recipe from about 10 years ago. They're very simple. You make a hazelnut shortbread dough. Couldn't be easier. Mm. Press them into a mini muffin pan. Make a little divot in the bottom. And then you just melt some chocolate chips and cream together. That's a ganache. And you pour that into the shell on top of your raspberry jam and top it with a raspberry. They're as pretty as can be.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here for a second because we've been talking about what each of these cookie recipes says about the decade or era from which they came.
Mm-hmm.
What does your chocolate hazelnut
It's totally
tart
in
say?
Keeping with the era because it talks. It's about the rise of the celebrity chef and the rise of restaurant cooking in the home. And this recipe was absolutely inspired by flavors I was, getting at restaurants.
And it's also much more technical.
I
mean, it's simple, but still fussier than the other ones. And it has more of a professional look to it versus the sort of homey cookies from the earlier decades.
Yeah. So this is the Food Network era right here. And actually, I made them. I had a party last night for 50 people. And I made these cookies. They didn't take long. They're actually quite manageable to do because you're just doing everything quickly and it's all in batches and it's not as fussy as you'd even think. You don't have to do them one at a time. It's sort of everything's done at once.
Okay, well, I'm going to eat one at a time. Whereas in truth, I want to eat about 7 of them
time.
But we'll give this a shot here. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Sorry, everybody.
Yeah.
So Amy, I mean, during the holiday season, it's, 4 to 6 weeks of culinary debauchery as we all allow ourselves. But do you think any of these recipes is sort of worth a permanent comeback?
Look, making cookies with local ingredients is a great thing to do. You're supporting local farms. I think we should all explore how to cook more with our local ingredients. And there's so many great things coming out of New England now. We live in such a golden era of local produce and ingredients. So I would say definitely the locavore. I think, the nut cookies are so timeless. Everybody loves gingerbread. Really, I tried to pick recipes that would appeal to kind of contemporary tastes. And a lot of them are quite altered from their original form just so that they could do that.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking us on this historical tour of cookies and for bringing them into the studio. They are actually all really delicious.
Thanks. I have so much fun working on this project.
Amy Traverso is the food editor at Yankee Magazine. You can find her updated versions of the recipes for all the cookies she brought us. It's at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. More dessert delights ahead. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so we've heard some great cookie recipes and about why so many of us have a real emotional attachment to those buttery treats. Perhaps no one knows that better than James Beard Award-winning pastry chef and restaurateur Joanne Chang. Joanne got her start baking chocolate chip cookies for her Harvard Mathematics Study Group, and she eventually sold them on campus. Following a brief foray into business consulting, still selling cookies on the side, Chang went to work for some of the best chefs in Boston and New York. And then she opened Flower, one of Boston's most beloved bakery cafes. Joanne Chang has two cookbooks highlighting the great recipes she uses at Flower: sticky buns, cheddar scallion scones, roast lamb with tomato chutney sandwiches, and bittersweet chocolate espresso terrines. Wow. But what really caught our eye in her book, Flower 2, is a special section in the back that, without fanfare or flair, connects everything Chang has ever done, from the Bûche de Noël to those chocolate chip cookies. It's a chapter on baking basics. So let's listen back to a conversation we had with Joanne, where she demystified the foundational techniques and recipes behind our favorite sweet treats.
As somebody who did not go to cooking school or baking school and had to learn everything either through books or on the job, I feel like oftentimes the basics are overlooked. And that's one of the reasons why with this book, I wanted to take the basic recipes that you kind of need throughout the book and gather them in one chapter so that if you wanted to just focus on learning the basics, you could learn the foundation recipes that you needed in order to do all of these recipes. And so if you start with the basics, then pretty much every other recipe in here kind of follows.
Now tell me, is that what you, since you didn't go to cooking school, but you worked so many terrific kitchens in both Boston and New York. I mean, is that where you got your education in the basics? Because in the introduction, you write in a lot of detail about your experiences there, but you don't necessarily say, oh, there was one dish in particular that I remember. It was more sort of technique and foundational knowledge.
Most definitely the recipes that I learned as my basics were learned in the various kitchens that I worked in. So, for example, one of the basic recipes is flour focaccia. It is the bread recipe that we use for all of our sandwiches. The flour focaccia was a recipe that I learned when I was the pastry chef at Rialto. It was their pizza dough recipe. And I saved it, I tucked it in my back pocket, and when it came time to open Flour, I recreated it and I shaped it into a sandwich loaf, and now it's our sandwich bread.
So I'm looking at the recipe here, and it's actually very, very simple when you look at it. 1 teaspoon active dry yeast, 3 cups of all-purpose flour, 1 cup bread flour, 5 teaspoons granulated sugar, 2 teaspoons kosher salt, 1/2 cup of olive oil, a small handful of cornmeal for sprinkling on the baking sheet. So what's the mistake that people make when they try to assemble a simple list like that and they end up with a hard brick, like I sometimes do?
Well, what I've learned in both teaching baking and in my own learning and in teaching baking and in helping people as they work through the first book and then hopefully with this book is that a lot of times people don't read the recipe from start to finish before they start. And it's something that I counsel everyone before they decide they're going to cook or bake is read the recipe from start to finish. Make sure you actually have all the ingredients before you start the recipe. And then once you have that basic knowledge of where you're going, it's sort of like if you're driving without a map, it's great if you don't care where you end up, but if you know where you want to end up, you really need to follow a map. And that's how I view the recipe. Like the focaccia is very straightforward as long as you follow the recipe, but you do have to have that determination that you will read it and follow it through.
Well, talk to me about another one of the basics in here, and that's the puff pastry. Because honestly, that's something that, you know, when you have handmade puff pastry, it tastes exquisite, especially if it's made by someone like you who knows what they're doing. But it's also one of the first things that I personally would run to the store to just buy the pre-made stuff. I'm ashamed to admit it, but because, I mean, it's hard.
Well, it's not that it's that hard. In fact,
I'm just impatient.
One of the great victories of this book that I was thrilled was that they actually did put a pictorial in the end that shows how to make the puff pastry, because it's not that hard. And time-wise, it's actually not that much time. It is extended over a long period of time, but your actual
time that you are working on the puff pastry is probably not more than 30 or 40 minutes total over the course of a day, or over the course of maybe 6 hours. And it, as you can see, the ingredients, very, very basic. It's just flour, salt, sugar, butter, a little bit of water. And the technique is so, when you make puff pastry by hand, it's really gratifying. You're right. You can just go to the store and buy puff pastry. And I've done that too. I will admit, sometimes I've done that too.
Okay, so I feel only slightly less shame because of that.
But one of the things I try to make clear in this book is that really you can enjoy cooking and eating so much more if you really buy the best ingredients. And by that, I don't mean going out and buying puff pastry. I mean buying great butter and getting some flour and making puff pastry and doing some of these basics at home. And once you have them, I mean, the great thing about puff pastry is you can make a huge batch of it and store it in your freezer and it will last. Mm. And so taking the time to find in the day to make a batch of puff pastry and then put it in the freezer. And then it's just like going to the grocery store when you need it, except it's right there in your freezer.
So in the recipe, under the special equipment section, you say a lot of patience needed. And so what do you have an insider's tip on the technique on what's the best way to roll it out? Because you got to roll and fold.
I forgot that I put that part in the book. The best advice I can give people who are looking to make puff pastry is you really want to own the rolling pin. And so there is a lot of rolling and folding. And if you're tentative at all, the dough will push back. It sounds crazy, but it really will. If you're kind of just hesitant and you're a little bit nervous, the dough's not going to do anything. You take that pin and you pound it down. You pound down that dough, you pound down that butter, and you roll. I mean, when I'm making puff pastry, I am sweating. I am on my tiptoes with all of my body weight pushing the dough out. But it's so gratifying when it all comes together and you can actually physically see all of the layers that you've created with butter and dough, butter and dough, butter and dough. And then when it goes into the oven and it poofs up and it's like shatteringly crisp, it's really amazing.
Yeah. You know, the last couple, we have about less than 2 minutes to go here. I wanted to ask you about, I know other people have before, but I noticed that you, in the new book, Flour 2, you've dedicated it to your parents.
I did.
So are they the source of your passion for food?
Oh, definitely. My parents, that's all they think about. When we are eating breakfast, we are planning lunch. And then at lunch, we're thinking about dinner. And then at dinner time, we're all thinking about what we're going to have for breakfast. It's so funny because my husband, who did not grow up in such a food-centric family as I did, is stunned at how often we talk about food. Our vacations are planned around food. I mean, everything we do is food-oriented.
And so, I was about to say that they must be thrilled with the fact that you've become so successful in a really, really difficult, I mean, industry. Being a successful restaurateur is no easy thing.
They are very happy. I think in the beginning they were a little bit nervous. They didn't know if I knew what I was doing. I didn't know if I knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's been 13 years, and now they're very, very happy, and they come and visit a lot. And they visit. They don't come to visit me. They come to visit the bakeries and the restaurant. That's literally all they do is go to all the bakeries and the restaurant. And every now and then they'll pop in and see me.
And finally, you know, in the introduction, we talked about something you mentioned in the book, and that is that you first got your start by baking chocolate chip cookies for your Harvard study group.
Correct. Yep.
The recipe for the cookies is not in here.
It's not in this one, but it is in the first book.
Okay. That's what I was wondering about.
Most definitely.
And
yes.
They're still among, the cookies are amongst your popular, most popular
items. Yeah, we bake hundreds and hundreds of chocolate chip cookies a day.
Okay. Well, Chef Chang, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chef Joanne Chang speaking to us about her cookbook, Flour 2, which includes some great recipes from Flour Bakery and Cafe. Now, Joanne Chang has finally honed her craft after taking a big risk to follow her passion. That reminds me of another couple, Kate and Jason McRae. Jason was a scientist with a background in chemistry. When he and his wife took a big chance, they decided to go into the candy-making business. Back in 2013, WBUR's Anthony Brooks visited McRae's Candies in Hyde Park.
That's the butter.
So it all starts with butter. Lots of butter. Then sugar, molasses, cream, and more sugar. And for this particular batch, some fresh ginger.
So when we do a new flavor, we start right back at the stove.
Welcome to McRae's, a small business in the heart of Hyde Park dedicated to the science and business of handcrafted caramels. Among the flavors here, ginger, maple, vanilla, rosemary, truffle sea salt, and my favorite, a caramel made with Ardmore single malt scotch. Think about it. Sugar, butter, and booze. Talk about a perfect combination of sinful deliciousness.
The Ardmore has a real nice, heavy, earthy, smoky finish. It's, it's very, very nice.
There's also that balance of how much do we want to pour into a batch.
So that's Jason McCray and his wife, Kate, who started McCray's about 2.5 years ago.
45 pounds.
So what's the secret of great caramel?
I would say patience. I was there as Jason was developing the recipe. And you stand over the stove and stir for sometimes 90 minutes, sometimes 2 hours, depending on how you're cooking your batch. It took a long time.
And I'm spreading it in the pan so that it won't overflow the edges.
Once all that butter, sugar, cream, and molasses have all cooked down, it gets poured out on a big cake
batch.
Pan.
The chocolate, just so gorgeous.
Looks like cake batter.
It does.
So this is a, 4 or 5 gallons of?
15 to 17 pounds.
15 to 17 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a huge, beautiful cake pan of warm, hot chocolate.
You got it. It's too hot to touch.
Yeah, very hot.
Yes.
Then it cools and gets rolled out by hand into a 30-foot-long snake and fed into an antique packaging machine that cuts it up, wraps the individual caramels, and shoots them out like bullets from the barrel of a gun.
80 to 100 a minute, depending on how well the machine is operating.
It's an amazing-looking machine. I mean, with all kinds of gears and cogs and bright red and nicely oiled machinery.
These were used in the early 1900s on the boardwalks. And so they were made so that you could wheel it out of your shop onto the boardwalk and fascinate everyone into buying candy.
I want candy, bubblegum and taffy. Skip to the sweet shop with my sweetheart Sandy. Got my penny saved, so I'm a sugar daddy. I'm a Hugh Crow.
Now here's the thing about Jason McCray and Kate Mitch-Morizen. They're both trained as scientists, biologists actually. And Kate has expertise in chemical biology, which it turns out to be a pretty useful background to have in this business.
This is all about chemistry, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you want to have the perfect temperature. Temperature dictates sort of the final hardness of the final cooled-off candy. And we like to slow cook it to develop all those nice flavors that we get.
I always loved the biology aspect. I love organisms. I love, I'm fascinated by the natural world. And that transitions, though, to the chemistry of things that are just wonderful, like a caramel. So to taste the difference between something where we didn't get it right and something where we did, that piece is what really interests me.
You sound like a vintner when talking about it.
I mean, we feel that way about our about our candy, because you once you start to feel the process, that's when you start to be in love, I guess. Yeah.
Love. They clearly love this business. In their small headquarters, a staff of 5 churns out as much as 100 pounds of caramels a day and sells them to 50 different stores and markets around the region. But they sort of stumbled into all of this. Back in 2009, Jason McCray was actually working for an insurance company that got bought up and moved out of state. He could have moved his family, but he didn't want to. So he and Kate took the plunge and moved into candy making.
So I was very much entrenched in love with Boston. So I had some free time, wasn't really interested in leaving the city. And with that free time, just was really messing around in the kitchen. I love candy. I've made candy my whole life. My mom used to make tons, just ridiculous amounts of candy, cookies at the holidays. And so ever since I was little, it's just that's what you do in the kitchen. So I was making all this stuff, messing around.
This is the wife's perspective was, you know, after a few months of looking for a job to replace the insurance job, our anniversary was rolling around, and I just insisted that we go away together for our 15th anniversary. And we went up to Acadia National Park. So we went up there and rode our bikes all over Acadia and stopped at junk shops
along the
way.
Junk shop.
And,
right.
And this started getting, it opens up your mind. It starts to give some new food to your soul of thinking, what do we want to do? We started thinking ice cream. We love to make ice cream, too. And we got a old crank ice cream machine, thought about making it into something we could use as a bicycle power.
But the thing is, the
juices were flowing. And we came home, and then the caramel started coming off the stove. Jason was making these amazing batches of caramel and giving them to friends. And, you know, the encouragement from them was incredible. It was almost something that once it started, it just took on a life of its own in a lot of ways.
It kind of spiraled out of control. And just sort of really thought about what it would really take. What would this really look like? How would you actually kind of make this happen? And I'm kind of a compulsive, systematic person by nature. Are you laughing?
No.
Yes.
I'm happy that you are.
and it just all sort of fell into place.
Although I will say it was a huge opportunity. We saw it as an opportunity. At that time, I still had an outside job, and people would say, "You're really letting him do this? He's not sending out resumes anymore."
Well, I said,
"You know, he has something here, and he's really happy, and this feels like, you know, us a lot of ways." A lot of the things we've been talking about over our years together, the path is right there for us. And
what was the hardest part? I mean, what was the hardest part of letting go of the past life, I guess, and embracing this one?
Uncertainty. You know, from we have a paycheck every week, but the way that we work together is we remind each other that we're up to something.
It's scary, but I always like to tell people, you know, like this old thing, like if I knew what it was, I wouldn't do it. But then I always try and remind myself, you know, the corollary to that is you have to look back and see what you've accomplished, too, because that's also something you wouldn't have accomplished if you hadn't have done this crazy thing. And the more you build on that, the more you realize you can actually kind of pull it off, and you build a strong team around you, and we've had nothing but encouragement from all the people that we respect.
So goals for the future, do you see you becoming global?
I do have a goal. I want to be like a national brand. The ultimate goal for me, I think, would be really cool to be have an American caramel in France.
Why is that? Tell me why.
Well,
that goal.
I think there's a lot of perception and expectation that French have the best caramel, and I think we make the best caramel.
And to have the French appreciate McRae's would sure feel good. We just love the idea of it.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, so much. I'll try this chocolate.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
You're about to give me some cavities.
WBUR's Anthony Brooks visited McRae's Candies in Hyde Park in 2013. And as for those goals Kate and Jason McRae had, well, McRae's is now sold at nearly 1,000 retailers across the country, and the company has grown so much they're looking for a new facility. And Jason told us that while you can't buy McRae's in France just yet, they're still working towards that dream. You can find out more information about McRae's and where to get their caramels at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. More sugar and some butter ahead. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Now, you can't talk about desserts without talking about chocolate. WBUR's Anthony Brooks takes us to Somerville, where Taza Chocolate is bringing an ancient style of production and updating it with fresh, bright flavors. Anthony went there with Andy Husbands, chef and owner of Tremont 647 and the Smoke Shop Barbecue.
Andy scours farms, fields, and in this case, a local chocolate factory to find the best ingredients New England has to offer and then whips up a tasty dish. For this adventure, he's cooking with Taza Chocolate, which is not your typical creamy European variety. It's stone-ground organic chocolate, handmade the traditional Mexican way. Taza's co-founder is Alex Whitmore, Somerville's own Willy Wonka.
I think the whole idea came out of a trip I took to Oaxaca, Mexico. One of my favorite culinary destinations. There's just an unbelievable amount of, I think, food diversity, amazing ingredients, and a really old culinary tradition, chocolate being a big part of that.
Que oracion, mi corazon.
It was gritty. It was kind of dark. It was a little bit bitter. It was really exciting. And he knew that he had to come back and basically build a company around it. So
a long way from Hershey's.
Yes, a very long way from Hershey's.
Our Taza chocolate factory guide is Sahail Ramirez, who says the inspiration behind the company is Alex Whitmore's passion for that bold, rustic flavor of Mexican chocolate.
He got in touch with his former boss at another company, and they decided Taza. Taza is going to be this local, organic, stone-ground, bean-to-bar chocolate maker.
So yeah. What does Taza mean?
Taza means cup or mug in Spanish. So that's really calling out a direct history of chocolate, because really a lot of chocolate that is consumed primarily in Mexico, Latin America, is as a drink. So the idea that you would take your chocolate, break it up into pieces, add milk, and then drink it, that's exactly what we want to connect people to.
The factory uses hand-carved granite millstones to grind the cocoa beans to produce chocolate in a variety of flavors, some of them unusual, like chipotle chili, ginger, and salted almond, among others.
This is a cinnamon flavor, Mexican style, if you'd like to try some. So the first thing you're going to notice, of course, is that texture.
Mm.
As you mentioned, not quite Hershey's.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What are you tasting in?
It's almost a flavor of cinnamon and floral. It's almost floral. I get a little bit of floral in there. And with there's a little bit of grit in there, it kind of keeps the flavor going. Like, you're still tasting it after a few seconds of eating it.
I feel like we could be talking about a fine wine here. It's great.
Absolutely.
Well, there's a vernacular for wine, but people don't use it for food very much, and I like to use it for food. This is also from, like, kosher.
Yes.
Right?
Dairy-free, soy-free, and gluten-free.
Wow.
In addition to being organic.
Right.
And certified organic, so.
And it's really delicious.
Some chocolate.
Because sometimes all that stuff you just listed means not delicious.
Right. Well, one of the things that's really important about our chocolate is that it's seriously good and seriously good for all.
The cocoa beans are roasted and winnowed right here in Somerville in a vintage machine that looks a lot like a giant coffee roaster.
Really, what we have here is something that dates back to the early 60s, and we found it roasting hazelnuts. So it is a vintage piece of equipment that we've repurposed for cacao roasting. And when we roast, we actually roast at a pretty light temperature for a pretty short amount of time.
It's a beautiful machine.
Thank you.
It looks like something you'd see in, the boiler room of a freighter.
Yes. I could see that.
I'm not sure what it would do, but it would have something to do with making the ship go.
I could definitely see that. Absolutely. And we actually didn't always have our own roaster. We used to have to take our beans to J.P. Licks on a Sunday and use their coffee roaster.
Thank you, Sue.
You're very welcome.
This has been
great.
It's my
pleasure. That's good. So shall we go upstairs and
Yeah, I'm still dying to know what you're going to cook.
I think we're going to try to do a cake of some sort.
Makes sense.
And maybe some hot chocolate.
All right.
Cold day.
Good
like
day
today.
For that. Yeah.
All right, let's go upstairs to the kitchen.
All right.
What's great about chocolate is it's really malleable. You can do all sorts of things. What I decided to make was everybody's favorite, a molten chocolate cake.
Mm.
What it's like is you cook it and you undercook it a little bit, actually. So once it's set, you take it out of your mold that you cook it in and put it on the plate. And then when you cut into it, it's soft and somewhat gooey. What's really great about these are the batter is very easy to make. All I do is I take some chocolate, I put it over in a double boiler.
Mm-hmm.
Chocolate and butter.
Butter, all the good stuff. So Alex Andy's here. He's doing a cake. He's doing some hot chocolate. What's your favorite thing to do with this chocolate?
Oh, my God. I just eat it. I think just eating it is definitely one of my favorite things, but I love it. I mean, one of my favorite things is going out to dinner and having an amazing pastry chef or someone like Andy making something that I never would have thought to do with the chocolate.
You can find Chef Andy Husband's recipe for his chocolate molten cakes on our website, but here's what he did for us. He cooked his batter over a low heat, sprayed the inside of the aluminum ramekins with oil, and then coated them with a light dusting of sugar, filled them up about two-thirds of the way, popped them in the oven,
and cook them at 450 degrees.
Normally when you're baking a cake, you're looking for a cake to be about 350 degrees because you want the outside and the end, everything to be homogeneous. But with this cake, what we're looking for is to sear on the outside to get to build that structure, but on the inside, not cook. This will take about 10 to 12 minutes.
And before you know it, they're ready. And the kitchen smells like warm, sweet chocolate heaven. And all you need is a dollop of whipped cream and a garnish of grated chocolate, and you are good to go.
Anthony, I think you should try this.
I think I should. I think you're right.
That looks great.
It looks amazing.
So what we're looking for is you look in here, see how it's just gooey in there?
Oh, it's amazing. Oh my God, that's so good. That's an amazing dessert. That is truly, truly delicious.
People love this. And I really want to tell you that, so you can make this batter ahead of time and keep in your refrigerator. I mean, like right before people come over, maybe make it. It's very simple to make. Have it. And then you're clearing dinner, put it in the oven. They're ready to go 12 minutes later. Mm. And people will love this.
And what could possibly be better than molten chocolate cake on a cold late winter day? How about washing it all down with a nice cup of warm, hot chocolate?
I've got this Taza cinnamon, which I thought I would use. And what I'm going to do is I have some milk. Pour that in the pan. Some heavy cream.
Nice.
Which, if you wanted to use just straight milk, you could. But as we all know, there's heavy cream is nice and rich. I'm going to add my chocolate.
So just dumping the chunks of chocolate right into the
milk and
cream.
You can do this in a double boiler, but I'm actually going to do it right on the stovetop with low heat. And then this morning, just for fun, I thought I would put some chai tea.
Great idea.
So it's like we're going to have this wonderful cinnamon chocolate. We're going to have our cream and our milk, vanilla bean, and a little chai tea flavor in there. I thought that might be exciting.
So here's the chocolate.
Andy, thank you. That was awesome.
Thank you very much.
Yum.
Yum.
WBUR's Anthony Brooks at Taza Chocolate in Somerville. Go to our website, radioboston.org, to find Andy Husband's recipes for molten chocolate cake and Taza cinnamon chai hot chocolate. All right, finally, before we go today, a different kind of sweet sensation.
You know what time it is, baby. It's time to get night. You better sugar, 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 sugar.
That's Sugar, the title track off the 2014 album by G Love and Special Sauce. Well, after an 8-year hiatus, the band came back together to create Sugar, and frontman Garrett Dutton came into our studios. G Love, without the sauce, sadly, but he did talk about the music, and he played a bit for us. People have called hip hop, soul, even sloppy blues. I'm not sure I like that one.
Funk, I like that one.
You do like that one. Okay, everything in between. Where did this sound come from for you guys?
We kind of figured out a way to mix up Delta blues and kind of old school hip hop, and that was, we didn't figure out a way. That's just the two kind of musics that we grew up playing, and I grew up playing, and then it kind of really clicked.
You're here with your guitar, so I'm wondering if you could play something for us off the new album.
You know, I live in Boston, again, and this is a song that I wrote about Boston and New York City, and this one's called Back to Boston. It goes like this. I'm going back to Boston, think I'm losing my mind. Going back to Boston, dropping on 9 to 5. Yeah, that New York girl, she ain't no friend of mine. Well, Boston cold, man, the women wearing too much clothes. Yeah, them Boston girls, they always gotta stay at home.
Garrett Dutton of G Love and Special Sauce. They'll be coming back to Boston to perform in February at the House of Blues. Go to our website, radioboston.org, to hear our whole conversation with G Love. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a sweet and wonderful holiday. This is Radio Boston. Yeah, baby.